one second, Rafi Jacobs. I spoke with the big chief, right? You're aware of that. I sent you a message. Remind me to pass this around and later.
Eric, I've asked you again today. You didn't seem very happy about it.
If he didn't throw you out, then take it as a tentative yes. It's rolling. Everything's rolling. Okay. I mentioned to some people before that Vic's brother-in-law died, Vic Snow, so he won't be here today. And his sister got to America. One, he has two sisters in America. One I know very well. I taught her children. She's ill, couldn't make the trip. But the other sister got here in time. At least they saw the brother-in-law at the very end. And they're here as a support for their sister who's sitting shiva. Hashem should be Menachem. Okay. First of all, just in relation to yesterday's shir, which was Amiyat HaMakzikat HaMeruban, I had to go quickly. All the elaboration on the Gemara's I quoted, you will find in the 340 pages in Rakefet Aharon Chelek Gimel, and you'll find a lot more coming out in Chelek Dalet. Now, Moshe Orbach asked the question, and we're dealing with Hafkat Kedushin, with Bitul Haget, so I have to say, as he said in class, he misquoted the Shulchan Aruch, and I also checked the Rambam, he misquoted the Rambam. And when you hear the Shia, you'll understand, I can't go into more detail now, why I said he was mevatled again in front of one person. I was very careful with my language, and I was dealing there with Tosfos. I know what was in my mind, but if I would start to explain it, it would take a long time. And the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam are dealing where he was mevatel before two people, and there's a big difference. And the Masham and Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog and all those, and Reb Avadji Yosef, were dealing with Bitul Bifnei Adam Echad. So I just want to correct Moshe, who's a big Talmud Chacham, but sometimes you misquote a source, and between one to two, there is a difference. Also, it's very makpit to say retroactive annulment of marriage, and that's the question he asked me, that there's some places where it's annulment on the spot. You grab the woman, you force her to marry you. I'm talking about retroactive, and in every retroactive case, there is a get. Okay, so there was a get. You'll listen to this shit tomorrow, but you'll see I was clear and right on. I just want to mention, we're talking about Reb Yitzchak Lichtenstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vedat. Torah Vedas, let me talk their language now. So it's a great moment, I have to say. It's really something, the Lichtenstein family, one son is the Rosh Yeshiva Har Etzion, another son is the Rosh Yeshiva of Teira Vedas, a daughter is what do we call her, Rosh Yeshiva, is their word for woman Rosh Yeshiva, a whole program for women that she established and runs in the Gush. It's a tremendous chut. It also tells you something about Torah Vedas, and I can't get this out of my mind, that sometimes I say something and I hit the nail on the head. For years I've been saying the greatness of a public institution vis-a-vis a private family operation. Many of the Lithuanian yeshivot were private family operations, and you all know what happened to Tells. It was a family operation, but when the family's not on the level, they don't take in an outsider. So Tells in Cleveland today is a mere shadow of what it once was. You have competition. Students don't come to Gris Kolel because the facilities are wonderful here. It's not the most wonderful facilities. I don't want to elaborate, but some of you know what's going on in the building recently. I walked in Friday morning. I was flabbergasted in the room where I do my Xeroxing. I didn't want to call Stephanie because I didn't want to ruin her Shabbos. So yesterday I went over to her. She says, "I'm ready. I know. She had 10 calls before Shabbos. I was the only one who didn't call. But people come because they're good classes. And it's to the credit of Torah V'Das, like YU, it is not a family-owned institution. It's a public institution. And Torah V'Das is now the only Hasidic/Haredi yeshiva in the world where the Rosh Yeshiva is a Yotzei Tzava Haganah Yisrael, where his son, as we speak, is doing is a commander in Givati, a mafaked in Givati, and his father is Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who wrote the article in Tradition that every young man in the world, including Rafi Jacobs and Shimi Alta, have an obligation to serve in the Israeli army, even though they grew up far from here. And Rav Yitzi is the Rosh Yeshiva. And in my humble opinion, when I look at all the pictures of Yitzi, I'm reminded of what his aunt told me. When Shulamit Meisman came in Aliyah, she called me and asked to meet me. I was very humbled. I had the same thing afterwards when the other sister came in Aliyah, the Rav's two sisters. Rabban had the same thing with Rabban Soloveitchik and his wife. And they thanked me for my work on the Rav. If I can quote them with due humbleness, they said, "My work is honest, it captures the Rav." I don't want to say another word. Hamei Vinyavin. So I went to see Mrs. Meiselman, and she, you know, we know of each other many, many decades. And we were speaking about her book. And she let her hair down and, she, you know, she said to me, "My son Moshe, we were upset with him, PhD from MIT, and you all know Torah Moshe, it's the only institution that the Abraham program had to know their connection with it because they were talking against YU in Torah Moshe." So this is Rav Moshe Meisman, but she said to me, I'll never forget this, "Today I've made my peace with my son. He has resuscitated my father, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik." When I look at Moshe Meiselman, and now when I look at Yitzi Lichtenstein, I see Reb Moshe Soloveitchik in front of me. Look at those pictures I gave out. That's Yitzi, that's Reb Moshe. Anyway, a sub-Talmud who's related to Rabbi Hecht, Dr. William Gewirtz, writes to me many years ago, 1966 is my best guess. I was at a Hanukkah celebration in Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's at Sal's apartment in Washington Heights. A young boy, I would guess about 3 or 4 years of age, came over to his father. I'm just talking about Yitzi. And he said to his father, "Yesh li kev bebeten." Tova Lichtenstein came out and the child turned to her saying, "I have a stomach ache." Rabbaran told us that if the Rav Zitzal were there, the son would have told him about the stomach ache in Yiddish. So here is a kid about 3, 4 years old who's totally fluent in Yiddish, Hebrew, and English. And there he is today, Rosh Yeshiva of Torah V'Das. All right? Even though I'm a great Zionist, but I'm still happy for what has happened in Brooklyn. I want to thank my dear student, sub-student, Jacob Sasson, the YU Mismach. I believe he's an actuary, if I'm not mistaken. And it's unbelievable what you can come up with on the computer. Shimi, do you kiss a computer every morning after you kiss the mezuzah? Yes or no? There's so much Torah in a computer. It's unbelievable. So remember I said in class that the Rav and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and maybe many others were makpid to use only machine matzah on Pesach. I'm talking about Shmurah matzah, I'm talking about the Brach, I'm talking about the mitzvah, the Oraita. And the reason is very simple. All of you know, if you've been in a machine matzah bakery and you've been in a hand bakery, and I've been in both, there's no comparison. With the machines, it is cleaner, it is faster, it can be supervised better. Humans are not getting involved. You have 18 minutes minus, etc. Fabulous. The only problem with the machine is, how do you do the lishma? But if you hold that pushing the button is lishma, then you've solved all problems. So you know what Rabbi Sasson came up with? From the Warsaw newspaper, the Heint, in 1924, so the bakeries, you know, that made the hand matzah wanted to publicize that the machine matzah are no good. And they had an ad, Vat harabonim ladat vashas chara gedola, machine matzahs lepesach, and that they're no good, they're not kosher. You should only buy hand matzahs. And then in response, an article appeared quoting Rav Moshe Soloveitchik that the machine matzot are probably even better than the hand matzot, and that he uses machine matzot on Pesach. So I have to say, this really is a find, and there it is from the computer. Finally, what I mentioned last week, I found what I was looking for, a substitute, Mel Humbleberger. Remember I said to you that there's not a descendant of Moshe Mendelssohn alive. He writes, my wife worked for a female descendant of him who is Jewish, albeit not from. According to my wife, who worked for us as a postgraduate fellow, she was proud of her descendancy. She is listed in Wikipedia. And I looked it up when she actually was a professor at Einstein College, YU, and comes from the Upper West Side. A fine Jewish family. I hope some of the members have come back to the core of Yiddishkeit, but I'm not certain she's a descendant of Mendelssohn. The fact that Wikipedia doesn't help us. The fact that she had a Mendelssohn name simply means she may be descendant of a cousin, a distant relative, etc. But as far as I know, when I checked Altman again, and I throw it out, if anyone listening can bring proof, as far as I know, I'm correct that Mendelssohn had one grandson who died Jewish, not one great-grandson who died Jewish. And now let us roll. There's a congregation in Lawrence, Shari Tefillah, where I was supposed to deliver this lecture last July. The Ribbono Shel Olam willed otherwise, and I was quite ill at the time. And whenever I get really ill, I lose my voice because it's the weakest part of my body. I'm always speaking. Even yesterday I gave shir, I thought I could collapse the rest of the day. At night it was Menachem Avil, someone who won Pras Yisrael, Professor Mordechai Rotenberg sitting shiver for his brother, and what a crowd of erudite people there, and they asked me to speak to Tzivishin Minchen Mariv, and if I would say no, it would be a disgrace for the Rav that a Talmud of his can't speak between Minchen Mariv, so I spoke. The weak part of me, okay? So I never gave this talk. I want to give it now. And I hope they're listening in Lawrence in Shari Tefillah. The Rav, very briefly, you all know, the Rav made many changes in his life. This becomes very important. I'll tie it together an hour and a half from now. The Rav made many changes in his life. He was born in Pruzhan. He spent his formative years in Chaslovich. Chaslovich, they ran away from the communists to Warsaw. Warsaw, he goes to Berlin. And he spends 1926 to 1932 in Berlin at the university. Now, just put yourself in the Rav's place. 1926, he was born in 1903. He's 23 years of age. He's a little bit past being a teenager. He certainly is not married. I doubt if he's gone out on a date with any lady. It was a different era, and he was growing up under different standards than some of us who grew up in America, and we're in B'nai Akiva, we're in Ezra, B'nai Akiva, etc. He was a secluded young man who grew up in the shadow of his father, although he had experienced a number of different countries. And now he comes to Berlin, and Berlin, it's hard to believe, Berlin was the center of the Western world. The culture, the art, the music, the intellectual atmosphere in Berlin, the professors, world famous, hard to comprehend that 10 years later Hitler would already plan the march into Poland and to kill every single last Jew who walks the face of the earth. And as we saw Shabbos, his influence continues until today. So now the Rav comes to Berlin, and here's a kid, a secluded background, what he saw in life. He saw Brisk, he saw Pruzhan, so his father, so his grandfather, so his uncle, Rav Velvel, so the Hasidic world in Warsaw, the Rav spoke about the Mudgets, then Gair. All right, and now he's in Berlin. What's fascinating, and I want to say something that go a little deeper. I believe, again, when you give a theory, you have to say, you know, I'm convinced I'm 99% right, but I'll say 90% right. I had a professor in graduate school, Professor Joshua Finkel. He said, whenever you give a theory, don't say you're 100% right. 90%. All right, fine. The Rav came from Brisk, and Brisk they never published. Why didn't they publish? They were perfectionists. Rabbi Rubin has a letter which he treasures, which is probably worth a few thousand dollars today, from the Rav to Yitzchak Rubin, and the Rav, Yitzchak had the chutzpah to write to the Rav and tell him off why he doesn't publish. And the Rav writes to him, you're right, I can just hear the Rav saying it, but what can I do? I'm too busy, family tradition. But when the Rav becomes the Rosh Yeshiva in YU, succeeding his father the year 1941, do you know who won the World Series that year? I would be sitting here celebrating the Yankees. I'm sitting here, my Boston hat, I have to put it on and face the music. God, disgrace to be born in the Bronx. I envy Yitzchak, born and bred in Boston. Yitzchak. So, you know, the Rav came into YU. I got to tell you the truth, Yitzchak. The students didn't know who he was. He wasn't the Rav. I don't want to tell you how they referred to him by his initials. And, you know, all right, he got the position. He's his father's son. Some of the students thought that way. I can prove it to you. I can show it to you in writing. Okay. So the Rav had to establish himself. So he published what I consider his magnum opus. I don't think it was ever equal. Although the world and philosophy. He published Ish HaHalacha. If you don't know Ish HaHalacha, Jack, have you mastered Ish HaHalacha? If you haven't mastered it, you don't know how to breathe there. This is the Litvisha oxygen that you have to put on when you walk in this world. I was sitting in my office and you almost saw the disgrace I'm subject to that next week in the Shia I'm calling Rav Nachman Mibi Breslev. And I swore Yomo to secrecy not to tell Rav Bornstein and not to tell Rav Gerelick. Charlie, my head will come off if they see what I'm doing next week. But Ish HaLacha is a masterpiece. And it was philosophy, shimmy. He didn't publish the Divrei Torah. You understand, he didn't want to get involved with Reb Chaim because he was always worried maybe he's not right, he's a perfectionist. But philosophy, you can't be wrong. You understand, this professor has this approach, this, he's a Cantonian, he's a Hegelian, etc., etc. The Rav published Ish HaLacha. No, Morty, to open up Ish HaLacha, what's the little introduction on top? A little introduction quotes the Gemara in Sota Lamed Vav Amid Bet. Beautiful Gemara. Yosef HaTzadik came that day to sin. The woman got to him. The young man, hormones, Yetzer Hara. I hope all of us here went through a period like that. If not, we're not normal. Period. All right. He's ready to give in. She's courting him. She's seducing him. And he comes that day, and the Gemara says, "The mut the yukna shel aviv nirata b'chalom." Remember the Gemara? That the image of his father appears in the window. Well, in my humble opinion, why the Rav introduced Ish HaLacha, what the Rav was saying, here I am, a young man, I've been exposed to Litta, I've been exposed to Mitnagdim, I've been exposed to Hasidus, now I'm coming to Germany, the hotbed of Torah im Derech Eretz. You know what that means? Torah im Derech Eretz. Wow. It's going to be wonderful, beautiful. But the image of his father appeared in the window. Despite all the years in Germany, he remained essentially a Litvak. The core was not changed. And if I can go a drop further, that image in Berlin became very tangible. Because in Berlin he met the person that I would say he related to as the second greatest influence in his life. And that was Reb Chaim Heller. And here the story is the Hashgacha Pratit. Berlin, it attracted, it was a pull, it was like a magnet. The greatest Jewish minds wound up in Berlin. The 1920s, it's beyond words who were in Berlin. We'll come to some of the names later. But Reb Chaim Heller was a Gaon Shebegaonim. He knew Kol HaTorah Kula. In addition, he had broadened and was a master of ancient Semitic languages, a master of text, of biblical criticism, of all the concepts that are part of scientific Jewish scholarship, which we'll come back to. But Reb Chaim's core was Ish HaTorah in the full traditional sense. And the Reb was overwhelmed with Reb Chaim. In Reb Chaim, he met, I'll use the words that the family used when I discussed it with them, a father substitute. Today you say Berlin, what the heck is Berlin? I probably can get on a plane in Berlin and I land in Warsaw within an hour. Anyone fly it? Am I right? An hour and a half? How long is the flight? Those days, I'm quoting the Rav now, when he said goodbye to his father at the train station in Warsaw and got on the train, I never knew whether I would see my father again, and he did not know whether he would ever see me again. And here he is in Berlin, and he has a home to go to, a person to turn to. I heard this with my own ears from the Rav. I'm going to quote him now verbatim. The Welt macht der Teus, wenn sie trachten, als Reb Chaim's gewen mein Rebbe. Nein, es ist nicht gewen mein Rebbe. Ich habe nur ein Rebbe, mein Tata. Aber Reb Chaim hat getan als Sach von mir, wenn ich habe gewen in Berlin. Es hat mir gewen a Gräse Hashba. I translate. The world makes a mistake when they speak of Reb Chaim Heller as my teacher. Look into the Judaica. I think they mentioned there Reb Chaim Heller as one of the teachers of the Rav. No, when the Rav came to Berlin, he knew Kol HaTorah Kula already. I'll show it to you. I'll prove it to you in a few minutes. But Reb Chaim Heller, the image, he didn't have a father. He didn't have a mother. Where was Europe? Where was Eastern Europe? Where was the Torah that he absorbed in his youth? Reb Chaim Heller was there. That was that relationship. And that relationship continued throughout the rest of the Rav's life. He later brought Reb Chaim to America, saved him from Europe. What do you do with Reb Chaim in America? Reb Chaim had organized the Beit Medrash Elyon in Berlin. I yet knew a few students who studied there, and they described it a totally unsuccessful institution. Why? In order for it to be successful, you had to be on Reb Chaim Heller's level. No one in the world was on that level. He wanted people in the Torah, Kala, Torah, Kula, combine it with Chachmat Yisrael. The Rav brought him to America. The Rav arranged at what we call today the Bernard Revel Graduate School. The Rav raised money for Yeshiva University, earmarked it for Reb Chaim Heller. but you just can't embarrass a man of Reb Chaim Heller's stature and give him a Murray, you're going to give him a scholarship, a fellowship. So they had Reb Chaim Heller every summer would give a shayur, a lecture in the graduate school. And he got paid for that lecture. He didn't realize for a lecture in Bernard Revel graduate school at that time, so you get paid for a summer of teaching $500. He was paid $5,000. That time, that covered your salary for the year. You know how the lecture went? I saw this with my own eyes as a kid. I wasn't a student, believe me. I was a kid. I wasn't born with the knowledge I have today. I wasn't born with a kippah on my head. This is not art school. This is honest history. You know how the lecture was? The students were sitting there. They were all talmidim of the Rav. The Rav asked them to come. Here was Reb Chaim sitting, little man. I have a picture in Revel. I remember that Soloveitchik family was amazed at that picture, how young and good he looked. Reb Chaim, it was his passport picture to come to America to get a visa. And the Rav would sitting, and then he would sit next to Reb Chaim, about 20 students in the class. Reb Chaim would speak for 4 minutes in Yiddish. The Rav would give a clap, and he would then translate what Reb Chaim said. Take him, if he spoke 4 minutes, it took the Rav 20 minutes to clarify it for the class. And then Reb Chaim would continue. This was the chesed of the Rav. You should know that when Reb Chaim died, Tuesday, after the shir, when he finished in Moria, he would take two or three balabatim with him, and they went to visit Rebbetzin Heller to see how the widow was doing. Ad kedei kach, the covenant, the chesed, the humanity, the regishut, the Rav, Reb Chaim. And let me tell you something else. B'didi haviyuv, that happened to me. Reb Chaim Heller had three daughters. Two of them married. One was Rabbi Singer, was his son-in-law. Anyone from Manhattan Beach in Brooklyn, he was Rabbi Joseph Singer, rabbi of a very big shul there for many, many years. I knew him. I knew the Rebbetzin. I knew his daughter. And he had another daughter. One daughter never married, but the other daughter married Perlmutter, a balabas named Perlmutter. Their son was my classmate, Israel Perlmutter, who I'm friendly with until today. This is the psychologist who lives in French, in Pisgat Zev, a lovely, wonderful human being. Izzy Perlmutter was my classmate. So, blessed to be after our third year in high school, I was a big matmid as a kid. Again, I have to say, to the praise of the yeshiva, Charlie remembers, the summer came, the building emptied, right or wrong. No classes. I pestered Ms. Abrams, we need a Rebbe during the summer. And yeshiva hired a Shanghai Sabava, Rav Shmuel Feibrashevitz, Sefer Tzadik Levracha, later taught in the BTA, and he gave a shir during the summer. And Izzy and I, and a nice crowd of kids, maybe 15 kids, we were all in his shir during the summer. So after 12 o'clock, whenever the shir was over, we ate lunch, we played ball in front of the yeshiva. And while Izzy and I are horsing around on Amsterdam Avenue, suddenly the Rav comes over to us. I knew who he was. I was a kid. Everyone knew who the Rav was already. And the Rabbi Soloveitchik, I'm shaking, and he says to Yisrael, Ayazay Devil Achzen, your grandfather wants to see you. And he took Izzy by the hand and brought him to Bernard Revel, where these buildings are not standing anymore. There were shacks that were built. Do you remember these shacks on on between 185th to 186th. That's where the Gottesman Library stands today. These were built with government money after World War II for returning veterans. All the universities got money to build additional buildings. You had more students. So in the first little building, that Bernard Rebel Grouchus, who was in that building, and he took Izzy to see his grandfather. And in parentheses, I have to tell you, if you want to know what life was like growing up, you're sitting here all burned up that Aaron Rakefet is clean-shaven and he's dressed like a Boston Red Sox fan or a Yankee fan and, you know, nothing, no black clothes, no payers, no this, no that. As a senior in high school, Izzy Perlmutter, who is a little bit more mature than the rest of us, Izzy Perlmutter grew a beard. A beard! Mr. Abrams called him into the office. This was on Thursday. He said, Yisrael, I've consulted with higher authorities, probably the Rav. We want you to know, if your beard is not off on Sunday, you're out. You're not in the school. You're expelled. And there were no two ways about it. When Mr. Abrams spoke, that was Putin speaking, not Trump, Putin, President Putin. Sunday morning, Izzy came back, minus the beard. That's what the yeshiva was like in the 50s, early 50s, I should say. So that's Reb Chaim Heller. Another little anecdote with Reb Chaim Heller. In those days, there weren't Xerox machines like today. It was much more primitive. So I would say our shiur with the Rav would take 2 hours, 2.5 hours. About 20 minutes, a half hour was lost. The Rav always needed Sfarim. Where did you get the Sfarim? On the second floor was the Gottesman Hebrew Rabbinic Library. So there was always a kid, Yitzchak, remember this? Always a kid, he would send, bring my Rambam, bring my Gemara, bring my... So he sends a kid, bring, we needed a Sefer Mitzvah of the Rambam. I'm an eye-ear witness to this. He sends the kid, it wasn't me, I sat here, but there were kids near the door. There was always a kid near the door who ran up the flight of steps and ran down again with the Sefer. So he sends a kid a Sefer Mitzvah. No, the librarian gives him a Sefer Mitzvah. The normal Sefer Mitzvah is published by Safagraph. I have a copy of the Safagraph company. The Rav says, Nein, it may nicht. Bring das zurück. Bring me a Sefer Mitzvah. Was Reb Chaim Heller hat euch gegeben. Only bring me a Sefer Mitzvah that was edited from manuscript, from Arabic. By Reb Chaim Heller. Morty, do you remember that Sefer Mitzvah? It beautiful. Schulzinger Brothers published. That's the only Sefer HaMitzvah that the Rav would use. Ad Kedei Kach was his respect for Reb Chaim Heller. Rafi, how old am I? I walk the streets of Berlin with the Rav. Am I putting you on or telling it as it is? I came in Aliyah 50 years ago. The American dream is make money, right or wrong. I knew right away I'm never going to make money in Israel. And unfortunately, the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, it was true. Everything was black under the table. The taxes, the war loans, thank God we're alive. I was on the books. Jewish Agency, State of Israel, Dai L'Chakima. But I said, if I'm not going to make money, I'm going to know Kol HaTorah Kula and all that goes with it. I never achieved it, but you can't accuse me of not trying. Got it? So I sought out what was beautiful about this area, particularly Rehavia, a little bit over, all the people who survived the war, all the Yekkes, the Germans, lived there. So I sought out, I cannot tell you how many conversations I had. Dr. Werner Zilberstein, name mean anything to you? He was the head, he was a medical director for the city of Yerushalayim, one of the nicest people I ever met in my life. His years, 1899, 2001. And when he turned 95, the family published, a private publication, a memoir of his years, particularly his youth in Germany. And I'm now quoting from page 24. In the 20s, I became acquainted with Josef Don Soloveitchik, a young man who had just arrived in Berlin from Warsaw, where his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, was principal of Talmudian school in order to study philosophy at Berlin University. And this is the tale how I met him. And Friday night I often davened at the Adat Yisrael synagogue in Zinguendorf. Charlie, what's Zinguendorf? It's a part of Berlin you don't know. All right, you're an American. I'm blaming you for what you're, that who your father is. I apologize. Your mother's also a Yekid? On both sides? Okay, I'm blaming you for both. What can I do? On one such occasion, shortly before the services began, the brother of my colleague and friend, the pediatrician, Dr. Jacob Levy, I believe Dr. Jacob Levy later is in Yerushalayim, davens in Yad Tamar, and I taught his daughter in Michlala, my first class there, postgraduate, 71, and she later marries the Rebbe Yaakov Weinberg's top Talmud after World War II, Rabbi Avram Abba. So Dr. Zuberman came over to me and said, please, just look around to the back. Whom do you see there at the back? I mean that young bacher. I did as I was told. I turned to Zuberman and said, oh, I see that young man standing. So what? He replied, please take another look at him. Do you know who that is standing there? That's a grandson of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav. Already now he is an Ilui, and one day he will be Chad Bidoro, quote, end quote. Wow. Introduction. Reb Avram Abba Weingott, that's the Talmud that Dr. Levy's daughter married, Joan Levy. It did not take long for us to become well acquainted and good friends. Imagine to be able to read this to you, an eyewitness account by someone who was part of this.
What's his name again?
The name is Werner, Dr. Werner Zilberstein. Zilberstein in English, Zilberstein. I have in my building, there's a new family moved in, Zilberstein. I would ask him if he's related. It did not take long for us to become well acquainted and then good friends. He often came to our home in Berlin, one of the few where he was able to eat without hesitation, even on Pesach. In this connection, I would like to relate an unforgettable episode. During a visit, a few weeks before Pesach, he replied to my wife's Raya's invitation to be our guest and say the night, quote, great, but could I please be present when you kasha the cooking oven? With pleasure, my wife replied, but with the request that you tell me quite honestly if something is not done correctly. I shall do it the way I learned from my Baba, end quote. Yosef Dov came at the appointed time for kashering the stove. After a while, he disappeared suddenly. I said, Raya, I've obviously failed the test. But lo and behold, a magnificent bunch of flowers arrived in acceptance of our invitation to participate in our Seder. It was on that occasion that I got to know the famous Brisker Shayorim, for example, Kisayat Matzah and Kisayat Mara. Okay, and here in parentheses, I want to move sideways. The story, these years picked it up. Bostonians, if they stop getting drunk today, the old timers probably could give you an exact year. You all know that the State of Israel has ambassadors in every country, or every important country, but America is so big, you have one ambassador, but you have to have legations in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston. And in Boston, there was a consular legation, and one of the key people, and this was unique at that time already, was a from Jew. And that Jew, Yudapayish, a Jew, had come in Aliyah and succeeded in Israel, and even the Mapai, who owned the country then, the Avodah, we call them today, they sent him to Boston. And he became very close to the Rav, came to the Sheurim on Sunday morning, Saturday night, and before Pesach, he comes to the Rav, Rebbe, I'd love to come to the second Seder in your house. It would be very, given from the Zayde into the sun, Sazenvi the Rav Pravet the Seder. Can you translate that? It would be very interesting for me to see the way the Rav conducts the Seder. So the Rav said, Adarabba, Kumbit, Ayafraya, you know. I don't know the name. That's why you need an old-time Bostonian. But I've yet to get his name. All they told me, yeah, we remember him. He's Taka, Frum guy in the Israeli office there. But no one that I've met yet recalls the name. Maybe Tova Lichtenstein may recall the name. I don't know. She was there. She certified the story. So the guy comes to the Rav for the second Seder. No, I want to ask you a question. Mark, you're in New Jersey, second day Yontif. Is it Yontif for you or it isn't? No, I don't have to tell you. 90% of the poskim will tell you it's not Yontif for you, just don't do malacha b'parchesia. All right, Rakepet has a different approach because he spoke with the Rav on it, but I'll never force my approach upon anyone else. But you're following the Shulchan Aruch. So this guy dances into the Rav Seder, and they wash for the meal, and the Rav makes the bracha on matzah and starts eating and eating and eating a shia, you understand? And this guy took a little bit matzah, like, to watch the Rav, and the Rav said, Nei, nichaltas, du bist echet mechuyev chaim sefraten the Seder. I hold you have to observe the second day. You have to eat a shia matzah like I'm eating. Then they come to the morah. And the Rav is having so the people said, by the time the guy finished eating, the Rav Shairim, all he could eat that night were prunes, nothing else. His stomach was gone. So that's what the Zilberstein is alluding to, that I saw the Seder, I saw the Rav, I was introduced to the Shairim. And he goes on and on describing the Rav and... But the most beautiful part, and this is what I alluded to, it's already a half hour ago, in those years, one could frequently encounter three men walking along the streets of Berlin who stood out even among Berlin's Jewry, which was certainly not short of eminent personalities. The three men were Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, with Professor Mittwoch, it's Egan Mittwoch, an Orthodox Jew and a distinguished Orientalist, and with Rabbi Chaim Heller, one of the greatest scholars of his time. And sometimes these three men were accompanied by Rabbi Dr. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, rector of the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary. Rabbi Heller was an eminent Lamdan. By the time he was 18 years old, he had worked through the entire Talmud, and he starts quoting now all his the Sefer Lachakirei Halacha. Then he worked on the Targumim, published on the Tirgumim of the Tanakh. He brought out the Pshita together with his daughter Mitya, who was proficient in the old Syriac language of the Peshitta. Could you imagine walking the streets of Berlin, the Rav as the youngster, with Reb Chaim Heller, with Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, with Professor Egan Mittwoch, and this Professor Egan Mittwoch, the Rav stood in awe. He was the prime example to the Rav of all that German Orthodoxy had achieved. He, and if you open up Rakefet's work on the Rav, go to the index, Professor Egan Mittwoch, you'll read word by word what the Rav had to say about him. The Rav described him. Here was a man who was dean of a graduate school in the University of Berlin, the Graduate School of Oriental Studies. And Professor Mittwoch, on Tisha B'Av, came to the university with shtechshich, house shoes, in other words, no leather, slippers, whatever the translation would be, and with a 9-day beard. And the Rav, who had a good sense of humor, so he says to the audience, I remember it like yesterday, it was being the 50s, says to the audience, I'm speaking Yiddish, let me go back to English if I can. Was trachtmen? As does this Columbia University? What do you think? This is like Columbia University? In the 50s already, there were Jews wearing yarmulkes in Columbia University. This is the University of Berlin. But he said his digduk in mitzvah, his observance, and your humble servant had the privilege of teaching Egan Mittwoch's niece at Michlala. She later marries Rabbi Forman. That's the famous Hadassah Mittwoch Forman. Rabbi Forman is gone already. Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. And I brought her a tape of the Rav talking about her great uncle. She was overwhelmed. But this to the Rav, this was German Orthodoxy. But it doesn't end here. I want to, one other paragraph, which Eti is a must. My friendship with Yosef Dov Soloveitchik has successfully withstood both time and distance. By the way, I was probably the first person at the time whom he told under the seal of secrecy of his connection with Tanya. Rafi, do you know who Tanya is? Tanya Levitt. The Rav will marry her. You follow? 1931, this is Tanya Levitt we're talking about, his girlfriend at the time. True to my principle that one must not pass on to anyone at all information giving in confidence, particularly of a highly personal nature, I did not even hint at it to my wife, Raya. Later on, she was to reproach me frequently and bad-temperedly for my silence. I have to tell you, that is fabulous. These are real people. Got it? Your wife, and you don't give her a little gossip that the young Beryl, who's been our house guest, who's so famous already, he's soon to be engaged to Tanya Levitt, who also was a student in the Greater Berlin area. She gets her doctorate from Jena University. So this is a little description. This is the Rav. This is Reb Chaim Heller. But notice that the name Reb Chiel Yaakov Weinberg is also mentioned. And here I have to tell you what I've concluded. Again, Dov, it's Rakefet trying to analyze. Am I right? I'm willing to bet 90% correct, but let me be humble and say 90% correct, not 99. All right, we'll stick to 90, but I'm willing to bet 99. You see, who is Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg? Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, this is why Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky got into such trouble. Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, you know who Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky is? Shimi, the name, Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky. You've heard of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. You've heard of Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky of Philadelphia. This is his brother, Rabbi Nassim. Rabbi Nassim is a genius as well. It runs in the family. But he published 2 volumes, Making of a Gadol. You've heard about those volumes? If you haven't, look it up in the New York Times. They burned the volumes on the streets in Mott, this stuff, in public. It reached the New York Times, did a whole article. There's a guy named Rakefet in volume 4, which will be out, I hope, by Pesach. If not, it'll be out by Shavuot for sure. We've got a giant step, a meeting with the publisher this Thursday, so we're now a giant step closer. Shimmy Rakefet defends Reb Nassim Kamenetsky, so you'll read it when it comes out and understand what we're talking about. But a great deal is about Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was the greatest Ilui, the darling, the top student in the Litvisha world. We're talking 120 years ago. We're talking Slabodka. But Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg had a very curious mind. He was more than just a yeshiva bacha. And then an incident happened that changed his life and changed the course of Torah history to a certain degree, a very simple incident. Tell me, what languages do you speak? English? What about Hebrew? All right. Malka and I had to work in communist Russia. Do you know what a fear it was? We had to go to addresses. Yitzchak, you knew where you were going. How do you ask advice? Malka and I have an expression. We've been in South Africa. We've been in Australia. We've been in Canada. We've been in America subsequently. We never worry. We always say we speak the language. All right? You get lost. You'll ask questions. In Russia, you're going to ask questions the middle of the night and somewhere in Riga. But the Ribbono Shel Olam was kind to us. We never got lost and we always achieved what we had to do. Shimi, Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was on a train and he asked directions in broken Russian. He never understood what they answered him and he missed the right train and he had to sleep in the train station, Murray, overnight, 24 hours. For the next train to come that would get him to Slabodka. He made up his mind to learn Russian. Dov, you went to YU, no one breathed down your back when you learned English and you learned Hebrew and if you wanted Spanish and French. I don't think we taught Russian at that time, but you had plenty of choice. In my time, there was German. I don't know in your time. I studied German in college to be able to read. Charlie, I'm not putting you on, these are facts. I actually won the awards for the best German student, Ralph Rosenberg, and by my second year learning German, Rav Hirsch started to come out in English. Suffice it to say, that was the end of my German, although I have a grandson who for some reason went to Berlitz and Chorev gave him permission. He learned German. He later taught for the Landa Foundation in Germany. So it shows him in a Shemayim there's something there. So Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg gets interested in language. In Slabodka, they were worried he'd become an apikoros. Most of the kids who left yeshiva to go to university, go to college, to broaden, they left the path of Torah. These were very difficult times. It's not like today where Baruch Hashem, they're more balei tshuva, I hope, than those that throw away Torah because of the Western world and lust and all that goes with it. So the Alt of Slabodka figured out, let's marry him off. If we marry him, it'll calm him down and he won't get so involved with secular studies. So they made a shidduch, a Rav had just died, the Bishviki Rav. That shtela, that rabbinate was open. Whoever marries the daughter, the Yatoma, will inherit the rabbinate. So he married the orphan, the daughter, inherited the rabbinate. But it was a marriage, I've told you many times, that didn't work out. She was much more simple and he was intellectual. But she was a wonderful woman. I was told by people, never say a negative word. She remarried afterwards and had children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and their descendants all over Israel today from her second marriage. But he was a bit of a loner. He was a genius, and if you're a genius, tell me, Rafi, do you have genius ability? What did they tell you in high school? No? Jacobs. What, are you a Jacobs or are you a Yakubovich? Which is it? Jacobs, I know Jacobs, they're one is brighter than the other. But when you're a genius, you got to be careful that you're not off the wall. Geniuses walk on the ceiling, not on the ground. It's rare that you find a genius that walks on the ground. In Yiddish, you say to that fellow, give him the greatest compliment, du bist anomala. Go back to Lakewood at me, 1954, 53. We'll talk that Yiddish and I'll explain it to you. Right now, till you're ready to go back to 53, just repeat, du bist anomala. Okay, Rabbi Chil Yaakov never remarried, but he figured I can't stay in Europe. People are gossiping. You're almost talking about me. I divorced this lady. I embarrassed her. Divorce was unheard of them. It's not like today. He went to Berlin. And in Berlin, he broadened. And he became very big in Chochmat Yisrael, scientific Jewish scholarship. That's the Talmud I inspired in BMT in the room at the other end of the hall. Professor Mark Shapiro does a doctorate under the field of Yaakov Weinberg at Harvard University, a brilliant work. And Rabbi Chil Yaakov was always caught between two worlds, and all of you know that, you've heard my lectures. On one hand, he could never leave Slabodka Yeshiva. His feeling was, if you're going to be from in a London, you have to go to a Litvish Yeshiva. But then afterwards, you have to broaden and get your PhD. And he was very involved in Chochmat Yisrael, Wissenschaft des Judentum, scientific Jewish scholarship. Where does Chochmat Yisrael differ from Talmud Torah? So, my dear Shimi, you'll go back to Rakefitz lectures 30 years ago on Germany, Chochmat Yisrael, spend a nice few weeks, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. Until then, you'll just verbalize like a semi-dummy. Got it? Okay. Don't listen, but why you pace me? It ain't worth the laugh. But the ability to give you a few jokes and a few shots, it's worth everything. Don't tell my Talmud Ari Berman, or they'll ask me to pay them for the privilege of giving Shirim. Shimmy back here. So Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg becomes the dean of the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary in Berlin. The dean. Okay? Now, when the Rav came to Berlin, and Morty, all this... I spoke with Avram Abba Weingart, who told me over word by word what his Rebbe told him about the Rav. Yosef Borg, you remember? Hours of conversation with Yosef Borg. All right? Werner Silberstein, Doc, he was in a different field. I couldn't really, this part of the Rav, I couldn't discuss with him. But this, I'm 90%, 99%, these are the facts now. When the Rav came to Berlin, he was intrigued. The Rav had intellectual curiosity. Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg was a shame dover, the great Elui, and afterwards Pilshviki Rav, and the divorce, and then Berlin, and the doctorate in Hildesheimer. He went and attended his classes. The word I use in my biography of the Rav, I remember that Yosef Borg asked me how I'm using the word, because he didn't realize, audit. He audited the classes of Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. Audit. Everyone knows the word audit, to audit books. But it's also used in relation to audit an accountant, audits your financial books. It also means someone who comes in occasionally, he's not an official student, but he audits the classes. The Rav went to Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg's classes. He attended classes in Hildesheimer. This is true. He was never an official student. He was a Litvisher who asked permission. I mean, Reb Chaim Zainichel should come and study. They're not going to say no. But he never adopted the Chochmat Yisrael approach. He was aware of it. He tasted it. But to a certain degree, I'll use the word, he rejected it. He went totally back to the world of Reb Chaim in learning. And Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg told Avram Abba Weingott, when the Rav was so famous after World War II, again, I have to speak Mamalash, and I'll translate, Ich habam de kent, et gekommen zu meiner Sheyurim in Hildesheim, aber ich kann nicht sagen, es geworden meiner Talmud. I knew him. He audited my classes, but I cannot say he became my student. Interestingly, they retained the relationship throughout the ensuing decades. When Aaron Lichtenstein, Reb Aaron Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, it's hard to have a world where Reb Aaron is not alive. When Reb Aaron married Tova, the Rav sent an invitation to Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. At that point, Mosad Rav Kook began to publish the Sri Deyesh. Those are the tshuva, that's what survives. A lot was lost during the Holocaust. New Yitzchak, do you know what happened? Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg sent the gift to the Chatan V'Kala, the first volume of the Sri Deyesh. Who did he send it to? Tova's address, the Rav's address, 10 Hancock Road. The Rav took all the Svarim he got. He's a brisk. He's going to look at new Svarim. He has time to look at new Svarim. Reb Chaim, you know what they found on his desk after he died? A Shas, a Rambam, a Shita Mekubetzet, and the Midrash V'Hamasa. I think that's the extent of the Svarim that Reb Chaim looked at daily. The Rav gave all his Svarim to the Gottesman Library. If you went to the Gottesman Library, I don't know until today what the story is, but all I know is until I went in Aliyah, and you asked them for Chelek Aleph of the Sri Deyesh, they gave you Chelek Aleph, Sri Deyesh, you opened it up, and you found a beautiful Hagdashah to Hagvedet Tova ben Harav Hagon, Rosh Kol b'nei Hagua Gola, Reb Yosef Tov HaLevi Salavetchik, in Bechirat Libo HaBachur HaTzayin HaNoda Lebaki Atzum, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita Bracha V'Atzlacha B'chol HaShetif Neh V'Rov Nachat V'Tizkul HaKim Bayet Neman B'Yisrael Yechia Yaakov Weinberg. That's where Reb Aaron Sri Deyesh wound up. The Rav didn't even open the Hakdashah. Maybe he looked a little bit inside the Sefer, and then he gave it to Gottesman. Okay, but the Rav was exposed. And this takes us back to what we said in class. I don't want to reiterate it in great detail. He was more than exposed, because he had his uncle, Reb Menachem Karakovsky, his uncle, who was of a Lashon, a graduate. This is the uncle married to his mother's sister, and a Gaon Adir, and they say in the entire Rambam, but they didn't have the money to publish it all. It was 1929, 1930, so they published on the first two orders of the Mishneh Torah, and that Sefer Avodat HaMelech is a rare, unique combination of traditional yeshiva learning with an overtone of scientific Jewish scholarship. And that was the story where the Rav was asked by his uncle, check the library, check the manuscripts. This is Chochmat Yisrael already. He got the Rav involved in the manuscripts. And this is my last conversation face to face with the Rav in 1983. I cite the exact date in my biography. And I said to Rebbe, I found four times where your uncle quoted you. And the Rav says, no, not just for six times. And when I got back to the Kollel, I asked my Talmud, Rav Yosef Klaus, and I told the story, both when I eulogized him here and eulogized him at the OU. I said to Yossi, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha Ahad, that he's gone too. I said to Yossi, how many times is the Rav quoted searching for Kitva Yad? And he reported back, I was wrong with four, the Rav was wrong with six, eight times in the Avodat HaMelech. So you see, the Rav was exposed to it. He didn't denigrate it. He didn't negate it. Certain Rebbeim, if Yomo will mention when he was back in Wayuda, certain Rebbeim, I've studied some Chachmat Yisrael, they would scalp him and hang him from the chandelier. Chachmat Yisrael, a nice papa trumpenik, a pushtak, and a pikaitis, get out of here. No, the Rav. But he remained a briska. Charlie, what's unbelievably fascinating, that the Rav had one son. One son should live and be well. My classmate, Rabbi Teitel, you know him by Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. And Chaim went on to become, he is the greatest scholar that's ever engaged in Chachmat Yisrael. A total synthesis between classic learning and the finest Chachmat Yisrael. He winds up at Hebrew University. He winds up studying with Professor Yaakov Katz, whom I still knew. These are legendary people. And these are people, Yaakov Katz. Do you ever meet Professor Katz, Yaakov Katz? You have his books. A short man. What this man had in his head. He gave Birchat Kahanim, he davened an old rift. I can show you just where he lived off Palmach. And he became a very great influence on Reb Chaim, my classmate. And when you look at his book on Stam Yenim, are you familiar with what Stam Yenim is? Can you drink Ayesha wine, Gallo Brothers wine? What's wrong with Gallo Brothers wine? They used it in, they didn't use it in the church. They didn't worship idols. Stam Yenim, a Gezeira the Rabbanan. This is not Jayanesach, right or wrong. Am I, you with me? Wine, we have to have kosher wine. Chaim's book on Yenim, it's his masterpiece, magnum opus, hundreds and hundreds of pages, with all the halacha, with all the French sources, the German sources, the greatest expert in how they made wine in the Middle Ages alive today is Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. So it's fascinating. And I'll tell you one more story about the Rav and Chachmat Yisrael, which also reveals. One time in the middle of class, you got to remember, in those days, it wasn't like today that every other day someone is going back and forth from Tel Aviv to America. Back, it's a different world today. When we came in, I never thought I'd see America again. I probably have flown with my wife over a million miles. We got involved with Russia and fundraising and speaking. And even yesterday I got an invitation. Again, I don't have that energy just to jump. But again, the place I've never been to, the other end of America, maybe one day we'll get there. I never like to say no, because if people want to hear your Torah, it's important. So someone came into the shiur, I remember like yesterday, again, this must be it's the 1950s, and he says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Professor Orbach, hab mir gebet, soll ich das zu euch bringen, ich lasse das euch da. Professor Feimeli Melech Orbach, make believe you heard the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Professor Orbach, who lived around the corner from me, he was a genius. He wrote Bali Tosfot. It's unbelievable, the Tosfot and their life. I mean, he knew Kula. These people knew Kula Torah, Kula, and they put it together. And when he put out the Bali Tosfot, the first edition, he had someone going to America, please give this to Soloveitchik. How do you know the Rav? He knew the Rav from Berlin. He was a Yekka. Professor Orbach was a German Jew who also studied in Berlin, but he was much younger than the Rav. Not a contemporary, but younger. So he had someone deliver it to the Rav. He was once a candidate for the presidency of the State of Israel. Someone delivered it to the Rav, and the Rav put it on his desk. And the Rav got involved in the shir, you know, and he walked out, and he left it on the desk. So we didn't know where the Rav went. Probably went into Dr. Belkin's office, but we weren't chutzpanim, you know, we were kids, Dr. Belkin, the Rav, we stood in awe. So I remember I said, you know what, let's bring it back to his mother's house. So we raced it across the street where he was staying, opposite the yeshiva, Amsterdam Avenue, and we gave it to his mother. We told his mother, your son left it in the classroom, and about 20 minutes later, the Rav walked into the Beis Medrash. Did anyone see the Sefer? He came back looking for it. We said, Rebbe, called the Mekrav Ani Aneh. We quoted from the davening, Aneinu, that Rebbe, we already brought it back. It's in your mother's house. It awaits you. But what did we see from that? He wanted to look at the Sefer. You follow me, Yitzchak? There was derech eretz for the Sefer. It's not that if you would show it to some of the other Rosh Yeshiva, they would have said, Nendas Havek, who needs it? What is it? Scientific scholarship? Because it? Ugh, it was very, very fascinating. He showed he wanted to see. Look at the Sefer. So that's the Rav. That's another part of the Berlin experience. That's the Chochmat Yisrael. And I think I've summarized it correctly. The Rav certainly didn't adopt that point of teaching. Never in the classroom did you feel there was the overtone of scientific Jewish scholarship as you had in Bernard Rebel Graduate School. But on the other hand, there wasn't an antagonism. And he certainly understood the value that could come from proper Jewish scholarship, scientific approach, but you remain a creature of your youth. Few people expand the horizons past the age of 29. And this too is a story that happened to me a few minutes walk from here in Michwala. I've always had outsiders sitting in my class, people who appreciate a Rebbe who does his homework. One of the ladies was one of the greatest ladies I met in my life, Dr. Shulamit Katan. She was also, well, you Germans have a monopoly on greatness today. She also was from Alsace-Lorraine, from Germany, then France. You've seen her son is very, she had a lot of children. She and her husband, Dr. Moshe Katan, Zikronim Tzadikim Levracha, they're very important sons and daughters today, PhDs, MDs, Rabbanim, Talmidei Chachamim. What a family. So she was librarian of the library in the Knesset. And she would come over to Michlala, and she always, my classes, she was a regular. So I was telling a story that happened in Boston. How do I know the story? It was the Yachei Kala. The Yachei Kala was later in life, again, I can't go into great details, but read my biography of the Rav, where they arranged for the Rav, after his wife died, he shouldn't be lonely, to teach students on the lawn of Maimonides during the summer, 69, 70, 70. It went on till the late 70s, early 80s. So about 75, I have the tape, Rabbi Manny Holzer, Zichrono Levracha, what he did for me with those tapes saved my life. So Manny gives me the tapes of the Yachei Kala, and I'm listening. And the Rav, again, the sheets aren't Xeroxed in front of him, and the Rav, no, bring me a Rambam, Hilchot Shabbos, Hilchot Shabbos, bring me a Rambam, Hilchot Shabbat, I have to look in. So a kid passes up what had just come out, the Frankel Rambam. Charlie, remember when the first Rambam came out? Smanim. Oh, Dov, what a holiday. Dancing in the aisle. What a Rambam edited. Everything you need in it. Except Rav Kook. Except Rav Kook. It's unbelievable how. And take a look at the election in Jerusalem. Degel HaTorah and Shas. Here's a guy with a beard, Haredi, nice guy, Rakepet's voting for him, support him. No, I'm not a Haredi Jew. I have a lot of hesitancy to look. I'm a Hared L'dvah Hashem, 100% I try. But wow, I look at the Haredim living here 50 years, between them and Yiddishkeit there's a vast chasm and gap, to put it mildly. I have more to say, but leave it for a different session. So the Rav, and this, and this, so the Rav, the guy passes up the Rambam. The Rav opens it. You hear on the Rambam I'm cooking. Bring me a Vashiva Rambam. I can't look at this Rambam. I'm not used to the typesetting. Bring me the old fashioned Rambam that was published in Warsaw. And I told the story in Michlala. And Shulamit Katan, who was a woman who was constantly growing and taking on new vistas, she couldn't understand that story. Rav Soloveitchik couldn't look up the Frankel Rambam. He passes it back. He wants the old Warsaw Rambam with all the mistakes in the text. But see, that was the Rav. Ultimately, the Demut the Yukno Shel Aviv. Nirata b'chalam. Okay, let me go one step further. Mori, you'll ask afterwards. One step further to do justice to Berlin. I have to say something I never said before. And once again, I think I'm 90% right. Mind you, the Rebbe's in Berlin. What a center of culture. And he came from a background that was anti-Zionist. Baruch Ator, the Noelan Melech Olam Shakoni Yebed Verom. He came from a background that was anti-Zionist. Reb Chaim, the letters of Reb Chaim, totally anti. We've lectured on this. Fine. And in Berlin, he's exposed to a very fine, occulted Agudat Yisrael. And as I've said 1,000 times over, before he came to Berlin, sure he knew Agudat Yisrael. He knew Agudat Yisrael from Warsaw. It was the hotbed of Agudat Yisrael. I get a Hasidim, much as the Hasidim, tens and tens of thousands of Jews. But there was Agudat Yisrael where Shalashuddhas, they sat down to eat a little herring with their fingers, some broken challah. In Berlin, you met an Agudat Yisrael with savoir-faire. When they sat down to eat shalashuddhas, there were two forks on the table, two knives, the portions, each one with different silverware, dignity. And he got caught up in Agudat Yisrael, and you know, in the Monday class, I've explained to you how later this affects him with Rav Leisa Silva, America, but there's something else I've never said. And this too, the Rav cried about. And I quoted in my work on the Rav, and I hold this to be very profound in understanding what happens to the Rav later. The Rav said, he had a conversation with a very famous rabbi in Berlin, one of the leaders of Agudat Yisrael. He did not give the name. I have a guess who it was, but I don't want to mention it because there's no way I can prove it. It's just a gut reaction. But he quotes the conversation, and he says that this well-known German rabbi said to him, "Yes, we're all part of the Jewish people, but I have absolutely nothing in common with the average Polish Jew. They can be Hasidim, they can be Litvakim, but they're not modern, they're not up to date. Maybe with Reb Chaim Moshe Grishensky." Yes, you remember the Rav quoting this? "Maybe with Reb Chaim Moshe Grishensky, I could have something in common." And this left the Rav thinking. No, it's a thought that bothered him, but it became, you know, you defense mechanism. you push it down to low priority. You don't forget it, but you live with it. You leave it. You move on. When we later come to the Rav after World War II, and that tremendous question that everyone is haunted by, so much has been written, well, I'm proud to say that in the latest volume on the Rav, they say that Rabbi Rakefet has spoken about it many times. Thank God they listened to the tapes. I recorded 9 hours, and I challenge you to say I didn't hit the nail on the head. One of the factors that turned him into a Mizrachiite was that statement by that rabbi. It troubled him. Maybe with Reb Chaim Moser we have something in common. But the average Jew? Oh no. Mizrahi was out of the ghetto. Agudat Yisrael remained in the ghetto. That haunted him. And when you're out of the ghetto, you're concerned with the Jews wherever they are. Take a look at what Nativ, the branch of the Mossad, did for the Jews in Russia. Remember, Yitzchak and I are living examples. When I was at Professor Rothenberg, when being Menachem Avoh, all he would talk about was how I sent him and Nomi, his wife, to Russia. And what they went, they were kicked out on Shabbos, by the way, you should be aware. There were people kicked out on, they always kicked you out on Shabbos. And Putin was the head of the KGB in Leningrad. He kicked out, I sent Mike Strick and Mayor Schweiger. Who kicked them out? Putin. They remember him sitting there throwing them out, looking at him. Putin's looks didn't change. He didn't grow fatter either over the years, as you know. He prides himself on being a sportsman. But what Israel did, take a look. The Minister of Education went to Pittsburgh for the funerals to speak. We're Klal Yisrael. These lies that are spread about us by Yesh Atid Party, Shem Rishon Yerkab, any Jew who votes for Yesh Atid, it's beyond comprehension. Well, look what they're saying. We hate the Reform and Conservative, they're not Jews. Hate? There's no such word. We pity the Reform and Conservative, because without Jewish observance there is no tomorrow. Our children assimilate. Statistics that are overwhelming do not lie. Anyone born of a Jewish mother who converted properly is as much a Jew as I am. There's no difference between us. Whether you observe or not, that's a different story. But we're all Jews. Halavai, we should all observe. There is no such thing as an Orthodox Jew. That's a kanad. It's a title of disgrace that those who threw away Yiddishkeit pasted on us. Orthodox means narrow-minded. I'm narrow-minded. My Rebbe was narrow-minded. The Baal Shem Tov was narrow-minded. What are we talking about? But if you're a Jew, you said Naseh V'Nishma. Defining a Jew means Shabbat, Kashrut, Taret Mishpacha, a certain lifestyle that enables us to continue. Gevet Toshav Anochi Imachem, the first words of today's Sedra. We are Gerim, we can't be like everyone else. We have to keep the distinction. And that always bothered the Rav. And I think it's one of the factors that he was able to make that change from Aguda, where he was to a certain degree raised, although even more extreme than Aguda, to leave Reb Lazer Silva, although Reb Lazer Silva held his hand after World War II and also moved on and become a Mizrachiite. And finally, I'm going to reveal something I don't believe I've ever said publicly. And this is not a theory. I'm sitting here, the Rebbe is sitting here, these 2 years. The late 50s, the late Meir Kahana, it's his 29th Yahrzeit now. I think it was Sunday. Meir, well, when was it?
Shabbat.
I think officially they had the Aliyah Lekev, I think, on Sunday. fingers. So I have to tell you, Meir Kahana, one day maybe I should give a lecture on him. I grew up on his lap. And that I don't totally agree with him, don't misunderstand me, but there was a lot of good in Meir. You can't deny it. I hold you can't work outside the law. If Jews start working outside the law, we'll shoot each other, because every Jew thinks he has truth. You have to work within the law, and you have to be humble. There are other opinions out there, but Meir's life, there are reasons why he became the way he did. I've written about it, and in volume 4, I have a bombshell. I have it all there, volume 4. Wait till you see. Okay. So Meir Kahana, we were growing up. Yitzchak, you didn't hear a word about Russian Jewry in Maimonides in the 40s into the early 50s. Right or wrong? We didn't hear a word. We were overwhelmed with the Holocaust, with the results, State of Israel. But then Meir started going public already in the late 50s. And suddenly we woke up, forget about the Holocaust, forget about the State of Israel. We have another tremendous problem. Millions of Jews being forced to leave Judaism and their attachment to the Jewish people, the totality of our existence. And I need not tell you, if there ever was a success story next to the State of Israel, it's freeing the Soviet Jew movement and what it ultimately accomplished. So one of the earliest times that Meir called for a public demonstration and he harassed Soviet diplomats, right after Shir, we're sitting around with Rebbe, and a kid pops up and says, Rebbe, should we demonstrate Russian Jews, the new issue that's been raised? And I now quote the Rebbe's answer word by word. What? It's not a question. We should act the way we did with Nazi Germany? Look what the results were. Here we have to be active. We can't make the same mistake we made in the 30s. That's an exact quote. I heard that with my own ears. Later on, the Rebbe became more sophisticated, and Rav Henkin quotes him correctly in Shelot Shvit B'nei Banim, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, that the Rebbe said, will demonstrations help? That's not for a rabbi to answer. You have to ask the experts in the field, Soviet-American relationships, and then you'll be able to answer the question, should you demonstrate or shouldn't you? But that original answer, where he compared inactivity regarding the Russians to inactivity in Germany, I never forgot that. And I think that also, looking back at Germany, looking back at those years he spent there, which he called the 7 good years, paraphrasing Pharaoh's dream with Yosef at Tzaddik. But that message later, slowly but surely, engulfs him. And that comparison, as one who was in Berlin and studied with Heidegger, and Heidegger, who later is accused of being pro-Nazi. I don't believe he ever stood.
He became a member of the camp of the Nazi.
Right. And he was. And later, he was not allowed to teach again in Germany. Now, I don't think he ever stood trial. He was never someone who was prosecuted. He didn't play a role on a practical level. But the Rav would speak about his own professors, people he looked up to. And could you imagine they join a party where they want to kill every Soloveitchik and every kin of Soloveitchik in the world? It's overwhelming. And this too played a big role. And there's no question, although the zenith of the
Free Soviet Jewry movement reaches its zenith when the Rebbe is already ill and old and can barely participate. But there's no question that that answer I heard reflects a mind state of the Rav, where you go back to Berlin, you take it to Agudat Yisrael, you take it to Mizrahi, and it moves on to the contemporary issue of that moment in time. So, let me summarize. I've not spoken about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I've not spoken about other people the Rav met, but to me, the issues I touched upon are the most prominent in the Rav's intellectual, emotional, and hashkafic development. Yes, Morty.
How did the Rav support himself in Berlin?
That's a good question, and the answer, I believe, is that his father transferred money to him monthly. He might have had some sort of stipend from the university as well, I don't know. But that's a good question. He came there, you know, it's not the way kids come to Israel with their charge accounts, etc. But I know his father transferred some money. And I can tell you afterwards, when Reb Moshe goes to America, remember, the Rebbe's in Berlin, Reb Moshe goes to America in 1929. His first year in YU is December 1929. So I know that the Feiner family, this is why the Rebbe was always Makir Taiva. I know that when Dean Zah would go to visit his mother every second year, he would go to South Africa, Shmuel Leib Zah, to visit his mother. So Reb Moshe got extra money from the Feiner family to give to Reb Shmuel Leib Zah, go via Germany, Hamburg, go to Berlin, visit my son, tell me what's going on with him. And from there, Reb Shmuel Leib went on, or either coming or going, I don't know. I mean, this I heard with my own ears from Reb Shmuel Leib Zah. But it could also be when he came, he brought some money for the Rav. If the Feiners and others were willing to arrange the trip, they certainly were willing to send something to help sustain him. There's so much more to talk about. I hope people are listening, because this material I gave you today, there are not too many people in the world who would be able to give you this and put it together, and, you know, these ears, what I heard, what I saw, what I looked at. And we actually walk the streets of Berlin with the Rav today. Let's not forget that. We owe a big thank you to Dr. Werner Zilberstein. So, these topics, what we're speaking about, and Reb Chaim Heller, Reb Achiel Yaakov Weinberg, Agudat Yisrael, and I finally want to end off, this may account for the Rav's unique approach. And Rafi's not here. I'm hitting. Will you repeat this word by word, or take him by the ear and make him listen to this on yutorah.org, okay? This may account for the Rav's unique approach. The literature world today, to a certain degree, the Hasidic world, for instance, there's always a critique of Lubavitch, that to Lubavitch there are only two types of Jews, those who are Hasidim and those who will become Hasidim. In the literature world today, I need not tell you what's going on in Israel, says it all. Degel HaTorah breaks from Agudat Yisrael. The enmity, the hatred, everyone says they have one truth. You go to America, I'm pretty sure in Lakewood you'll meet an element there, although not everyone for sure. You'll meet an element, they'll say, what, you're a YU guy, you're a nice swap, you're this, you're that. Everyone, and by the way, the Moetzet, the Torah in America, there's certain great Rabbanim who are not part of the Moetzet. They will not accept them, they will not elect them, because they're too open-minded. I mean, you take Reb David Feinstein, you'll take the Nei Yisrael crowd, Reb Yaakov Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha Yibavel, with Reb David Feinstein, these people are too open for them, you know. They can accept YU people, etc., etc. They tell people to go to college, and it's a great shame. But you see, the Rav was very different. when I look at that picture, Yomo, you know that I made a Sudat Mitzvah the other night to say goodbye to a dear friend, colleague, student who's going to New Zealand next week. And we also celebrated the fact that in 29 people sitting before the Rav in the 1960 picture, after so many years, I identified 29 out of 29. You don't know how much work it took, and the final one was Izzy Wind, Kanein Hara, and Zecher Zichrono Levracha. And then you look at that picture again. Who are they? What became of them? A third, 40% are no longer alive, though. Every week I hear another bad story. You look at them, so many years later, it's 1960. Everyone else is retired from that picture. There's only one guy still going, teaching. I mean, I use the word going strong. I acknowledge the Nayin Hara. A guy named Rakefet. He's teaching, they say, better than ever. I hope so. But you look at that picture. Who's there? You know what became of them? This is not a child array. Every last leader of every spectrum of the so-called Torah world. Right-wingers, centrists, left-wingers, they're all sitting in front of the Rav, B'defilu u'rechimu. It's Rebbe, each one. And each one will swear to you, he's going exactly the way the Rav wanted him to go. And you see, the Rav is very different. Don't do what I do because I do it. I'm quoting him. Tuva sechtu, only emulate me when you think I'm right. He never forced his hashkafa upon any of his talmidim. There was a certain broadness. You could walk in with a beard and prayers. No one's going to tell you to take it off. You could daven with a gathel. You could say, Shalom Rav by Mincha, Rasim Shalom by Mincha, Nusachari. There was a certain breakout there of broadness. And in my humble opinion, a lot of it had to do with Berlin. He saw the Hasidic world, he saw the Litvish world, and he now saw the Torim, the Recheretz world. He saw a world that was battling with Chulcha, Ger V'Tosha V'Nochi Imochem. And the Rav understood there's a lot out there beyond his own thinking and his own way of life. And this too, when he spoke about Egen Mittwoch, on the other hand, he complained, German Orthodoxy, not enough lamdis, not enough lamdanim. I told you, if you look at the curriculum of the Hirschian Reali School, the high school in Frankfurt, you're thinking you're looking at the curriculum of Ramans. But he understood that these are all beautiful fruit on the tree of Torah, the Yirat Shemayim. And this too, the Reverend Berlin, I got from him. I hope in my own life I've been an example of someone who tries not to be negative. Positive. Choice. Everybody has. And finally, I'll end off with a Litvish joke that contradicts everything I just said, but it's the Rav. One Litvish joke you all know. This kid came over to the Rav Saturday night in Boston after the major talk, and this kid, a Ramaz graduate in Harvard now, the Rav's cup of tea. And the kid says to Rebbe, give me a bracha. And the Rav says, what are you, an apple? You see, he couldn't understand. Give him a bracha. Not Siddiq Rebbe. But the best one is, this too is a true story, a Hasidish guy is coming to, is in Boston, he goes to the Rav Shurim, he loves the Rav, and finally he can't contain himself, has to be a Baal Tshuva, and he says to the Rav, Rebbe, why is it you don't wear a gatel? No, a gatel, to divide the body, dominating is a taisvis, alright. Someone once asked me, I said, what are you, an idiot? I'm wearing a belt. A belt is a gatel. By the way, that's a good answer. It's a proper answer. Professor Elman, when he davened after class, would take off his tie, and he was chassidish, his tie became his gatel. So he says to the Rav, Rebbe, why don't you wear a gatel? And the Rav looks him in the eye and says, the only gatel I know is a gatel you put around a puzzle of Sefer Torah. And he said, I hope I'm not a puzzle of a Sefer Torah when it's pasul. What do? You put the gatel on the outside so you shouldn't go up and use it to lay in from, right? It has to be fixed. So the Rav said, the ain't sick a gatel vasichken, it's the gatel you put around a puzzle of Sefer Torah. My dear students, next week we return to the regular role. I wouldn't miss the Sunday class, the Monday class, for all the greatness in the American economy, which has now gone up, what did I say, in one quarter, at least 2.3%. Wow. If Trump is not reelected, the Americans are not interested in their pocketbook. New York Times, I have a lot to give out. Synagogue massacre, the New York Times write-up. Here, a result of the massacre. Every shul should have an armed guard. This is appearing in the five towns now in their newspaper. Great news. Belfast Bakery was free to refuse gay marriage cake. Ruling by the Supreme Court in London, in England, and it's based upon the Supreme Court of the gay marriage cake in Colorado, the baker that refused to make it. Thank God.
In Colorado, the decision was the opposite.
No, the Supreme Court overturned it. And here the Supreme Court of England overturned an earlier decision. New York Times, this is yesterday, I believe, it's getting harder to talk about God. Very interesting article by a believing Christian. And I just said that to my grandson last night in a different discussion, that there's no God left in the Western world. England, France, America, Canada. Now, why you? Ani model HaKadosh Baruch Hu, two copies, Rakefet is not crazy. My wife is right on. We came back from New York so upset with, after spending 15 days on the YU campus, how many kids were walking around without kippah. Hard to believe. The latest commentator, how bare heads are more than just bare heads and why it matters for YU. Two copies. What we're up against, Mazel Tov, this is the mayor of New York, proposes that we don't list the baby as a boy or girl, list the baby as baby X. Oh, and then you'll decide, the kid can decide, be transgender, what he wants to do. And here's the New York Times complaining that the Trump administration, it's not the word for it, that the Trump administration is trying to define transgender out of existence. It goes hand in hand. Here are a number of copies. I love this. Of Reb Yitzchak Lichtenstein mit a litvische Yiddish, you should hear it, this young man, and a git sein eshte sheyua in Perivadas. He has resuscitated his great-grandfather, Rev Moshe Soloveitchik. Beautiful article on Nat Lewin's mother. I knew about this. She is the chutzpanit who opened up the miracle of Sempo Sugihara. It deals with Holland. She was a Dutch citizen, and she was the one who actually forced them, and they say over 100,000 people are walking the face of the earth who were saved by Sempo Sugihara. Follow me, their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Overlooked no more, this is the New York Times, Rose Zarr, a Holocaust survivor who hid in plain sight, a beautiful, beautiful article. And these are people who survived and knew nothing of Yiddishkeit, their parents weren't from, and they become from in America, but a beautiful, beautiful article. This is all baseball select. Now running for office, Adam Greenberg. Do you remember Adam Greenberg? That was the Jewish baseball player who came up to the major leagues and his first at bat got hit by a pitch that almost killed him. He never played. One more time, they allowed him, they did it on purpose, they brought him back. When he recovered, He came up for one at bat, so he should go into the record books that he had one at bat in the major leagues. And he later played for Israel's baseball team. When they tried to form the baseball team, he's now running for office. Beautiful article. How the New York Times covered the 1916 World Series, the last time the Dodgers played the Red Sox in the World Series. Babe Ruth, a book just came out. First Modern Celebrity by a Jewish lady, Jan Levy. She wrote on Sandy Koufax. And a very nice review. Maybe I'll wind up with the book yet. Name one really famous baseball player. We'll wait. This is an article that lo aleinu in America today, baseball has lost its attraction. The youth know the basketball players, the football players, but they're bought stiff with a sport where there's no clock running. This is the New York Times, a new article on Boston doesn't properly appreciate the Babe. And they developed the theme, his granddaughter's interview, that he didn't only play for the Yankees, he did great things in Boston, and all his life had two homes, New York and Boston. This is amazing. Here's my story. We're now in Chabad, and believe it or not, this is Shimshon Halperin. How many of you know him? Larry Halperin. I know this guy for 70 years or more already, and he becomes a Chabadnik. He lives here. He's Aaron Batt's brother-in-law. He's married to Aaron Batt, Zecher Tzadik Livracha's sister. Now, this is to drive Yitzchak crazy. Two copies. Tefillin selfie for Tefillin doctor. That's the doctor who did the research that if you put on Tefillin, you live longer. It helps the heart conditions. And here he is visiting Chabad. Here is Rabbi Meir Bastramsky. This is a kid grew up in Israel, totally irreligious. And what the Rebbe did for him and sends him back to Israel, very, very fascinating story. Here's Chabad reaching out to Goyim, friendship circle for people who have illness, what Chabad is capable of doing. And you see, that's the difference between, that's what I told Jomo, don't tell Rabbi Gerulich and don't tell Rabbi Bunshtein what I'm going to quote next Sunday in Shir. You can't put Chabad down. They do things. We don't do it. Mark, you don't do it. I don't do it. Jack doesn't do it. We do other things. But at least it fills in the puzzle. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming, all the people listening across the expanse of the world, including, I hope, some people in Shari Tefillah. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Jack,